And you're listening to Morning Edition on KASU. I'm Jonathan Reeves. And joining me on the phone lines right now, we're talking to U.S. Representative Rick Crawford. Mr. Crawford, thanks for joining us and welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning to you. First, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on Kirstjen Nielsen leaving her post as a Secretary of Homeland Security. How do you think that's going to impact the agency?
Well, anytime you have a change in leadership like that, there's a little break in continuity. There's a little bit of a disruption, but this guy is, by all accounts, a professional that's going to be taking her position. And, ultimately, that's the president's decision to make. I'm sure she didn't just walk in and resign. I'm thinking this is probably something that was discussed. The decision was made. It was probably best for her at this point to resign. I think the president probably wants to go a different direction on border security and views this new guy as maybe a little more, a little tougher on that, given his background and his history.
I think that it's been a little bit I know a lot of talking points by way of that this seems to be like a lot of these posts are like a revolving door. Do you think it's because the president is that hard to deal with, or what do you think it is that specifically is causing so much rotation in not just this agency but all the agencies?
Well, in this agency in particular, this is a difficult job. And quite frankly, I'm not sure either side really has the desire to see this issue fully resolved. It's a wedge issue. And, I'm really getting tired of talking about it all the time. I think we should quit talking about it and do something about it. But I think a lot of people agree with me on that. But it's the nature of Washington, and, I think it's this particular job, this particular post, is perhaps one of the most difficult in the entire cabinet with regard to, not only does it have a very sensitive policy issues, but there's all the political blowback for even just implementing enforcing existing law. And so it's a difficult position to be in, but across the spectrum we've seen some appointees come and go, and I'm not sure exactly what you can attribute that to. I know that this particular post is one of the more difficult, if not the most difficult, jobs to have in any administration.
I know that President Trump had said in addressing illegal immigration at the southern border with Mexico, I know at first he said that he would close the southern border and then kind of backed off that threat and issued a new one saying he would put hefty tariffs on cars made in Mexico if the country didn't do more to stop the flow of migrants coming, and drugs coming north. Your thoughts on either one of those attempts, do you think they would be successful in trying to help with the problem of illegal immigration?
No, I mean, I think you can lock down the border in a manner of speaking without necessarily disrupting commerce. And so I think that's probably the better approach. I don't think, particularly on the heels of this USMCA, the replacement for NAFTA, I'm not sure that's the best tactic to employ. But the other thing is Mexico doesn't necessarily have a Mexican car manufacturer. What you have down there are U.S. automobile manufacturers, maybe some other foreign automobile manufacturers, that final assembly in Mexico, and then they make their way across the border. So I'm not sure that's even the best approach with regard to, trying to take some sort of punitive action to force Mexico to be a better partner in immigration enforcement. I'm sure there's some things we can do differently. I'm not sure that's the thing you want to do.
U.S. Representative Rick Crawford joining us here on KASU. Some Democrats, let's ask this first of all. What are your thoughts on the Mueller report? Let's talk about that for just a few minutes. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's somewhat vindicating in that there were two other Russian interference investigations, one in the Senate and one in the House. Both came to the same conclusion as Mueller. So we didn't have to spend upwards of $25 million to come to that conclusion. So the fact is that the Mueller investigation is complete, and I think it's time to get past it. The thing about it is, think about 2 years ago, when it was not quite 2 years ago when Mueller was appointed to this job, whatever you want to call him, and he was held up by the Democrats as a paragon of virtue. He's a straight shooter. If anybody can find, corruption and collusion, it'll be him. And we heard this for a long time. We heard threats of impeachment if President Trump tried to fire him or Rosenstein, the guy that appointed him. You know, there were threats of impeachment. There were, you know, all kinds of statements made about how important it was for Robert Mueller to get his work done, and he was going to be trusted to find the right conclusion and all this. And then when they started to realize that, you know, really not a whole lot to see here, it became clear that this wasn't going the direction they wanted it to go, then they started to try to discredit him and subsequently discredit the report. And now they're trying to not only discredit him and his lack of thoroughness in the investigation, but also now trying to discredit Barr, who was very clear in his confirmation hearing that he was going to allow this investigation to continue and he wasn't going to interfere, and that he would issue a report immediately, which he did, a four-page report on a 400-page report, a synopsis of that 400 pages. And so, but now they're trying to discredit Barr and say, well, he's just an agent of this whole thing, and he's part of the Trump machine and all this other kind of nonsense. It just, they won't let it go away, and there's a reason for that. It's politically motivated, and they're trying to keep this narrative alive through the 2020 cycle.
Do you think that the full unredacted report should be released to the public?
I think the full report should be released. In fact, I voted to that effect. I'm not sure that you can expect an unredacted version. Now, as redacted as little as possible is fine, but you also have to understand that, you know, you do have to respect grand jury findings and some of the information in the grand jury, and also sources and methods. So it's one thing, you know, you sit back in the abstract and go, we want to see every bit of information. I get that. But also you need to allow the intelligence community and the leadership in the DOJ to make an informed decision based on what can be out there in the public sphere. And so we got to be careful about asking for the complete unredacted version without first having it reviewed thoroughly and make sure that we're not violating any grand jury protocols or any sources and methods that might further complicate future investigations.
U.S. Representative Rick Crawford joining us here on KASU. Well, one more thing I want to ask you about. The Arkansas Times reported that you and other Arkansas representatives last week voted against the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act in 1994. Why did you vote against this?
Well, it had it wasn't a clean, straight reauthorization. I have voted for it in the past, and if we got a straight, clean reauthorization, I'd vote for it again. But again, what happens is you take an issue like this and you put it into a more of a political context, and it becomes not a good piece of legislation. And so there were some problems there that I had, as most of us did, that it wasn't a clean reauthorization. There was political dynamics to it, and we didn't want to support that. We would support a clean reauthorization. I have done in the past.
What were some of the problems you had with it?
Some of the language with regard to tribal adjudication of sexual assault, some things like that. There were some restrictions they placed on certain entities and reporting requirements that I think were inconsistent constitutionally. But it wasn't a clean reauthorization. And so, again, what you have is the leadership on the other side taking an opportunity to try and turn a good piece of legislation that should be supported into a statement, into a political statement, and just not going to support that.
There were some people who were critical about this, saying that it was maybe part of this was that it was a vote against women and a vote for guns, and that the NRA was against this piece of legislation. Would you like to comment on that?
No, I think that's inaccurate. And again, anytime that you have a difference of opinion, the other side is going to characterize that in a negative way. And that's to be expected. My vote, my no vote, had nothing to do with the NRA. I don't understand why they have to, go there, but that's just something that they do. Again, put a clean VAWA on the floor, and I'll support it.
Mm-hmm. What are some things that you're working on?
Well, I'm working on a couple of things. I would like to see, we have farmers that have really been behind the eight ball, and not just around here. Certainly we have, you know, have had our share of difficulties, but where we're seeing widespread financial problems are in places like the Southeast, in places like Georgia, Alabama, Northern Florida, South Carolina, where farmers have just been, because of the hurricanes, the storms that came ashore last fall, we haven't been able to provide any disaster relief. So I'm working on a bill and have been for about 8 years now, but I've got some traction on it now because people see how important it is, and that's to set up these farmer savings accounts that allow them essentially to fund disaster relief on their own while they're awaiting either insurance adjustments or possibly even supplemental appropriations from Congress. But in the meantime, they've got to have operating capital to keep their farm going. And so these accounts would serve there with some tax incentives to fund those accounts and being able to draw on those accounts without tax penalty for the operation of your farm. It's almost like an HSA for farmers, mm-hmm. and it's widely supported. But because it's a tax-based piece of legislation, we don't have authority in the Ag Committee to move it. So I've had difficulty trying to get folks on board. Well, now, with all these disasters that we've seen and so many farmers behind the eight ball, they're seeing the merit in this. And so hopefully it's something we can move sooner rather than later. Unfortunately, it's going to be too little too late for some farmers, but hopefully in the future it will be meaningful for farmers to help mitigate disasters as they come around.
And is it something that could help farmers if they, you know, because with that particular profession, as you know, you can't predict what the weather is going to do. And a devastating flood could happen at any time. Or, you know, we live in an area where, you know, Pocahontas and some areas, they just see constant flooding. Of course, there was a lot of farmer fields up around that area, too. If there was a disaster like that to happen, could this be something that could help farmers this year? Or are you talking about that might be a little too late for farmers this year, but maybe hopefully next year might help?
Well, the way it works is you can put into this account up to $50,000 per year with the tax benefit of that $50,000, and it's capped at $250,000. And then, of course, you draw on that account with no tax penalty throughout the life of that account, and you can continue to replenish it. But the maximum tax benefit you can receive per year, $50,000, and once you've maxed out at $250,000. So most farmers are probably not, under these circumstances, are probably not going to be able to put $50,000 cash in today or even at the end of this year. They might. But where it starts to really turn into benefit is after you've funded that account, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, and you've got a significant amount of money. Now, the other thing that's interesting to note is that this can also help collateralize production loans. So bankers like it, ag lenders like it, because somebody's got to administer the account, and then ag lenders like it because it helps collateralize, to a large degree, production loans. And so it's a good thing to have. And the other thing is, we haven't had very many of these lately, but when you have a particularly good year, rather than, you know, taking the money and going and investing in, you know, new equipment, which you could do to reduce your tax liability, you can fund this account, which reduces your tax liability, but it doesn't incur debt. So you're not only getting the benefit of reducing your tax liability, but you're getting the upshot of not incurring debt as a byproduct of reducing your tax liability. So it's entirely scalable. It can work for a farmer that's growing, you know, tomatoes on 50 acres, or it can work for a farmer that's growing rice and soybeans on 10,000 acres. It's very scalable, and it can work regardless of whether you're a livestock producer, poultry producer, forestry, any level of agriculture is going to benefit from this type of account.
U.S. Representative Rick Crawford, we have run out of time, but thank you for joining us as always. We appreciate your time this morning.
You bet. Thank you.
U.S. Representative Rick Crawford joining us here on KASU. It's right now 8:34. You're listening to Morning Edition.